Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight. Marcia Langton makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute, and Warren Mundine is here for the first occasion. I'll be very brief as usual in my introductions, and of course we're discussing the issue of Indigenous affairs, a new conversation. Both our speakers will speak for about 15 minutes and then we'll have questions and discussion and finish no later than 7 o'clock. Now, both our speakers are well known, but I will introduce them briefly. We'll start with Warren Mundine, who's the current chairman of the Australian Indigenous Chamber of Commerce. He's an executive with the Australian Employment Covenant, as well as the chief executive officer of the Entscorp Limited organisation. And of course, he's the former national president of the ALP. And Professor Marcia Langton is the foundation chair of the Australian Indigenous Studies department at the University of Melbourne, chairman of the Cape York Institute for Policy and Leadership, and patron of the NPY Women's Council. But of course, Professor Langton's also a well-known author. So thanks to both our speakers for coming along, and we'll start with Mr. Mundine, go to Professor Langton, and thank you very much.
Thanks for that, Jared, for that great quick introduction. Okay. Thanks, ladies and gentlemen, for having us here tonight. A couple of little formalities. One is I'd like to do an acknowledgement for, I wish to acknowledge that tonight's speech is being held in the country of the Gadigal people, the Darug Nation, and I acknowledge that the ancestors have been custodians of their country for thousands of years. I also want to acknowledge my own ancestors, the Bundjalung, Gabanga and Yuin peoples, who have also been custodians of their land and their country for thousands of years. I acknowledge and pay my respect to the Gadigal, Darug, Bundjalung, Gabanga and Yuin peoples, elders past and present. I also, just on for the what's been happening, unfortunately, for the last few days, also acknowledge the Victorian fires, and my heart goes out for all that loss and all the people who have suffered in that. And my mind boggles as the figures just keep them coming up every day. So my heart goes out for them. So thank you very much. First thing, for people who are coming up tonight thinking that Tony Mundine, that Anthony Mundine was going to be here, I'm Warren. But I can understand your confusion because of we're very similar athletic frames that we have, or sporting frames. Anthony was telling me the other day he's getting a bit sick and tired of it too, because he was in Melbourne and a whole heap of young 18, 19 year old girls come up to him, very attractive, and said, "Warren, give us your autograph." So with that introduction, I'd like to go on to give a bit of a quote that came out of the Productivity Commission's Overcoming Indigenous Disadvantage Key Indicators from 2007. And it stated that across virtually all indicators in this report, wide gaps remain in outcomes between Indigenous and non-Indigenous Australians. Despite Australia's world-class health system, the life expectancy of Indigenous people is estimated to be around 17 years, lower than that for the total Australian population. Despite compulsory education, Indigenous students at all levels experience much worse outcomes than non-Indigenous students. And Indigenous people are significantly overrepresented in the criminal justice system, unfortunately not as the lawyers, but as both victims and offenders. just looking at some of those statistics, and I'm building up a bit of a case here, is you start looking at Indigenous rates in health, that those figures are life expectancy is estimated to be around 17 years lower than that for non-Indigenous people. Estimates for males are Indigenous is 59 years, so you know the next 30 years I'm starting to get a bit worried. Non-Indigenous is 77 years. Estimates of females Indigenous is 65 and non-Indigenous is 82 years. In 2005, death rates were higher for Indigenous people than for non-Indigenous people in all age groups. The great differences were for those aged between 35 and 54, where Indigenous death rates were 5 to 6 times those for non-Indigenous people. So in my age group level, the death rate is 5 to 6 times higher. In fact, I spend most of my life, and this is one of the things that motivated me to start looking at a new way of doing a conversation in Indigenous affairs. I worked out 4 years ago that I could go to a funeral just about every week within my own community, let alone the community across New South Wales and Australia. And it was all people between that 30 to 50 year age bracket. Kidney disease was 5 times as high as the non-Indigenous rate in 2001, and in 2004-05 it was 10 times as higher. So you've got a graph that's getting worse. And of course, the dread, of course, of diabetes. Indigenous people are 3 times as likely as non-Indigenous to have diabetes. In fact, from the age of 35 onwards, my own anecdotal evidence of just looking around in my own community, I know only of about 2 people of that age bracket who don't have diabetes. Law and order issues. We've got between 2000 and 2006, imprisonment rate for Indigenous women increased by 34% in a 4-year period. For Indigenous men, it increased by 20%. You have murder rates. Women are 11 times more likely to be murdered than non-Indigenous women, and for men, it's 9 times as much you get likely to be murdered than non-Indigenous males. In education, in 2006, 21% of 15-year-old Indigenous people were not participating in school education. Only 5% of non-Indigenous in that age bracket were not participating in school education. These are national figures, so it's across the board nationally. When you start drilling into regional areas, the statistics get worse. In 2006, Indigenous students were half as likely as non-Indigenous students to continue to year 12. In 2004 and 5, a small proportion, 22% of Indigenous people than non-Indigenous people, 47% had completed year 12. The proportion of Indigenous students who achieved a year 12 certificate after being enrolled in year 11 the previous year changed little between that time period. Okay. We go on to employment. In 2004-2005, adjusting for age differences, the labour force participation, and these are not my words, these are the report's words, all these. The labour force participation rate for Indigenous people was 58.5%, was about 3/4 of that for non-Indigenous people, which is 78.1%. The unemployment rate for Indigenous people, 13%, was about 3 times the rate for non-Indigenous people, about 4%. Again, these are national figures across the board, which range from the inner city areas of Sydney to the most outback remote areas of Australia. I've been in communities where there's 100% unemployment. And not only that, there's been employment at such a high level for generations. From 1994 to 2005, the participation rate for Indigenous women increased from 42% to 53%. The rate for Indigenous men was constant. The Indigenous unemployment rate fell from 30% to 13% in that period. The unemployment rate fell for both women and men. But the interesting thing about that statistic is, of course, CDP participation rates remain stable in that area, but CDP participation significantly reduces recorded Indigenous unemployment rates and increases recorded labour force participation rates, particularly in remote areas. So what we were doing was moving people that was previously recorded prior to 1994 as unemployed, they were now being recorded as employed, but in CDP. Issues of home ownership, where the proportion of Indigenous adults living in houses owned or being purchased by a member of the household increased from 22% in 1994 to 25% in 2004-2005. In 2004-2005, the proportion of Indigenous adults living in home ownerships or being purchased by members of the household in remote 18% and very remote 3% areas was much lower than in major cities, 29%, and inner and outer regional areas, 39% to 32% respectively. In 2002, the most recent year for which both Indigenous and non-Indigenous data are available, a much lower proportion of Indigenous adults, 27%, than in non-Indigenous adults, 74%, lived in houses owned or being purchased by a member of the household. Now, what I'm getting to is that if you're looking at those rates and you're looking at the policy that was announced last year from the Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd, because this is also the period that the week of the celebrations of the 12 months since the Prime Minister apologised and said sorry to the Indigenous population of Australia, in which we are celebrating, you can see the closing the gap that they have to do is massive across the board. And if we're going to start looking at closing that gap, period, those statistics where the Aboriginal population, the Indigenous population, I mean, is equitable to the rest of Australian population, then we're going to do a hell of a lot of work to do that. One of the things that come up recently out of the 2020 summit and also through the efforts of Andrew Forrest was the 50,000 jobs initiative, the Australian Employment Covenant. People say, well, why? What's this magical figure about 50,000? You look at the closing the gap figures, that's 100,000 Indigenous Australians we have to find jobs for over the next 10 years, or Indigenous poverty, because that's what we're talking about when you look at those statistics, Indigenous poverty will get worse. So we have to create 100,000 jobs. The idea of the Australian Employment Covenant is to give that economic technical term, the oomph up front, so that we can start making significant changes over the next few years just to keep us in the marketplace, but also to get ahead of the unemployment figures, and that so we can start making significant changes in that closing the gap to make us equitable to the rest of Australia in regard to those employment areas. It's going to be a massive task, and it's going to be a big battle to make those changes. We started looking at these statistics and looking at the funerals that I talked about earlier. One of the things that made me start thinking about the conversation, because being National ALP president, and prior to that, because you just don't come out here in a vacuum, you go to heaps and heaps of conferences, state and national conferences of the Australian Labor Party, and you start seeing the difference about how Aboriginals are treated, Indigenous people are treated. Sorry, I'm an old fellow. I was brought up an Aboriginal, now it's got all trendy to be Indigenous, so I pop backwards and forwards sometimes in that language. is when we're talking about what we're going to do for the rest of Australia, centre to that was the economy, economic management. And from economic management and the economy, we dealt with issues of education, we dealt with issues of infrastructure, we dealt with issues of housing, we dealt with issues of health, and so on and so on and so on. But the conversation was the economy. You go to any Western democracy in the world, you will see that in the election campaigns, the major issues is the economy. But by some sort of magical shift at the Australian Labor Party conference, but it's not only our conference, it was everywhere else, when we started talking about Indigenous issues, all of a sudden we started talking about welfare. The language changed immediately. We talked about welfare, and human rights issues, and the economy dropped off the discussion straight away. And as soon as you started mentioning the discussion, people thought you were some sort of mad person. So I said, well, how can we start turning this around? And I thought one of the best ways to do this, because if we're looking at what Aboriginal people do have, Indigenous people do have, is land. 20% of Australian land mass is Indigenous for various legislations and freehold titles. What I did was, okay, let's start a debate about land reform, because any economist will tell you, if you're going to start looking at breaking through the poverty cycle and having people who were in communal home ownership and communal land ownership, and you're going to start looking at breaking that poverty cycle, then land reform is one of those things. Now, it wasn't a lot of rocket science that went into this, and quite honestly, I'll make a confession here. I was sitting at home one Sunday afternoon, and I thought about 20% of land mass, land reform. If we're going to get people into building up their asset base there's a good banker sitting in front of me, starting getting bankers to invest in communities, that they need to start looking about having land reform so people will invest, and the land titles will give security to those investments. So over a period of an hour, I worked out a media release and got a friend of mine who worked in the Premier's Department in New South Wales to release that. And he had actually picked up very quickly on it that it was going to be a major issue. And he said, you sure you want to release this? And I said, yeah, sure, it's a Sunday afternoon, no one will really care about it. And he said, okay, so an Aboriginal person talking about land reform and going against the wind of native title and land rights is not going to make it an issue. I said, okay, so he pushed the button, it was sent out. But I got up from my lounge chair, walked out the front door, got in my car, and before I turned that motor on, I had 32 interviews. The media went berserk, because here we are talking about a whole issue of land reform and title. We need to start the new conversation through the economy. The economy has to be central to all our discussions in regard to how do we break the cycle of poverty within the Aboriginal communities, Indigenous communities, and Indigenous individuals, and how do we start moving forward to dealing with all those other issues that then will create a sustainable economic progress for our communities, because the statistics are telling us in such a wealthy country that we are not going well at all. In a lot of areas we're improving, in a lot of other areas we're going backwards. Land reform is one of the issues. 4 years ago I was booed at and spat on at a native title conference at Coffs Harbour. Today it's acceptable, the land reform issues. A lot of people are accepting it and saying you do need to look at land reform, you do need to look at home ownership, you do need to look about how we invest in our own country to start moving things along. Other things were raised by to start to create the environment for an economic change was Noel Pearson with his welfare reform from the Cape York, where we said, how do we start to encourage people to start getting into jobs and start moving along? One of the interesting issues with the CDP stuff, Aboriginal people, when I started talking about the horticultural, getting Aboriginal in the horticultural industry, people said, well, they won't move. How are you going to get Aboriginals to travel in that? You know, it's not in their country, they're not in their culture, not in their psyche to travel. My answer was very simple. It was a very simple answer. We invented the word walkabout. We traditionally used to travel and look for work and do things. When I was growing up in the 60s in rural New South Wales, my uncles, my grandparents, my aunties used to travel. They used to work in the shearing industry. They used to work in the horticultural industry. What CDP did, through good intentions, was pay people the dole, the work to stay at home, and they didn't travel. So you work 1 or 2 days a week, 3 days a week at the most, you received the payment, you didn't have to travel, you didn't have to look for work. So it stopped us from taking up our natural travelling and cut us right out of, weaned us right out of the out of that horticultural rural industries and that. Today, and I was sitting with the National Farmers Federation just before Christmas, and even in this economic climate, they're looking at 100,000 job shortage within the rural industry. Aboriginal people can fill those jobs. We have to start creating the environment for that to happen and starting us moving across into those areas. The other thing I found interesting with the Indigenous communities was that we had two things that I thought were very good, which were community activity and government activity. So we had community activity within the Indigenous community, but we had government activity. But the thing that was missing, which a lot of the Western democracies and many other economies depend on, private activity, private enterprise, private investment, Indigenous people being encouraged to take up their own work and setting themselves up, and self-employment was missing from those areas. And it was through government policies and through government legislations over the last 30 years for those things that sort of weaned us out of that area and stopped us from doing those things. We really have to start focusing on the debate, the new conversation. The new conversation is about economics. It's about bringing Indigenous people out of poverty and to driving them forward into the wider Australian mainstream economy, but also into the global economy if we are going to get out of these areas. And it also means to look at our things in a cultural area as well. I was in Canberra last week, and it was raised to me by Aboriginal women from the Northern Territory who said, you know, if we're really going to break through this area, we're going to have to start getting Indigenous women to be equal and to be treated as equal before the law, and that's the LAW law as well as the LORE law. And so there has to be major changes within those areas that happen. And if we don't do that, then we're always going to be keeping ourselves and our communities back. And I'm waiting for Jared to wave at me and say, get off. I'll leave it at that. I look forward to the questions and I look forward to trying to answer some of them. Thank you very much.
I'm sorry about this. I forgot my glasses, so I have to... The red case. The small red case. Thanks. Sorry about this. Thank you. It's a great honour to follow Warren Mundine, and also thank you very much to the Sydney Institute and Gerard and Anne for inviting me. And also I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this place, the Gadigal people of the Darug Nation, and also add, as a resident of Victoria, my own condolences to the families of those lost in the bushfires. Not far from here, in January 1788, the British Navy officer Captain Arthur Phillip brought his fleet ashore and established a penal settlement and gave effect to Captain James Cook's declaration of possession, which had been made on Possession Island in 1770, to the eastern half of this still mysterious continent. I've described the events that followed in my chapter in the book First Australians, an Illustrated History, published last year by Mygunya Press as a companion to Rachel Perkins' brilliant and award-winning television series First Australians, and Rachel's here tonight. In the following chapters, historian James Boyce, Bruce Pascoe, Wayne Atkinson and others describe in detail the painful revolution in Aboriginal life that resulted from their subjection not only to a new polity but a radically new economic regime. The British graziers and farmers altered most Australian landscapes by clearing trees on a massive scale for their herds and crops. This, along with the military, paramilitary and vigilante enforced population removals, brought to an end the ancient hunting, gathering and fishing economy of the first Australians across most of the continent. By the end of the 1940s, only a few Indigenous groups retained their pre-contact lifestyles, and although limited, impaired or controlled by various means, their societies continued in Cape York, Central Australia and the Western Desert, some areas of the top end of the Northern Territory and the Kimberley region of Western Australia. Elsewhere, surviving Indigenous populations became entangled in the new economy which had transplanted their own, from the hop growers of Corranderk to the pearl shell divers of the Torres Strait. The ingenuity of the first Australians is as marvellous as their very survival in the dire conditions of the frontier conflicts. the assimilation policies that were formalised and entrenched in the state and territory governments in the 1940s, so that the role of Aboriginal labour fitted the British caste system operating throughout the empire. Servants, coolies, indentured labourers, controlled population and other means of extracting labour cheaply had been mastered in India, Africa and elsewhere. In Australia, though, there were no special arrangements with the local chiefs or ruling families as there had been under the Raj in India or with the ruling aristocracies of Malaysia or elsewhere. As well as removing the embarrassment of coloured children whose miscegenous origins posed a threat to the establishment of a British way of life with British wives and household domesticity, the policies of removing Aboriginal children from their families was a Labor policy. Those exempted from these policies remained on Crown reserves, gazetted for the benefit of Aborigines, whose racial identity was formally, in any case, that of full bloods. The reality was quite different, of course, on the ground. The idea that a burgeoning coloured population in North Australia was a security threat in the first half of the 20th century was also a factor. Hence, race and economy were intertwined throughout Australian history, although this historical process was to a great extent invisible in the cities. The social revolutions of the 1960s and 1970s, in which Gough Whitlam, Charles Perkins, H.C. Coombs, W.E.H. Stanner, Barry Dexter and many others played key roles, could be described as a series of odd, distinctively Australian decolonisation experiments. In retrospect, we can see more clearly that the isolation of remnant Indigenous populations in an archipelago of Crown reserves posed a series of economic and social policy conundrums. Such a small number of men, they were, we can see now, who turned their minds to the human rights disaster located on the outskirts of many rural towns and in city ghettos. I have been rereading Charles Raleigh's trilogy, the most detailed economic history of Australia's racial frontiers ever written. He explains the history and facts of Aboriginal life on the margins of Australian society and economic life up to the 1960s. In the new appraisal of the life and work of W.E.H. Stanner in An Appreciation of Difference, the contributors reveal that Charles Rowley declined the invitation to join Stanner, Nugget Coombs and Barry Dexter on the Council of Aboriginal Affairs. This august body advised several prime ministers, and the body's work represents a sharp break with the post-frontier thinking, which the members found in their discussions with politicians, officials, missionaries, reserve superintendents and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people throughout the continent. What I found most striking in An Appreciation of Difference and in rereading Raleigh's works is the origins of present-day debates, if such they can be called, about Indigenous policy in Australia. It was clear to the members of the Council of Aboriginal Affairs that the thousands of Aboriginal communities across the country, the numbers greatly accelerated with the equal wages case and the dismissal of thousands of Aboriginal pastoral workers, required modern titles to enable Commonwealth investment in desperately needed infrastructure to ensure the security of these communities from yet further incursions by corrupt or malign Aboriginal affairs officials in the states and territories. The Commonwealth Social Security Act had been extended for the first time to Aboriginal Australians. The amendments to the Constitution following the 1960 referendum brought the Commonwealth fairly and squarely into the Australian Gulag archipelago described by Raleigh, and the Council's members were faced with the task of whether to bring Aborigines residing on reserves in from the cold or to leave them in the economic wilderness that the Aboriginal protectorates had created. Remember that a large part of the Aboriginal population at that time was already involved in Australian economic life, and somehow the achievements of high-profile Aboriginal people during those years, remember Lionel Rose, the boxer, or Darby McCarthy, the jockey, or Kath Walker, the poet, seemed less extraordinary then than did Cathy Freeman's victories to a later, more romantically inclined Australia. Raleigh did become involved later with the establishment of the Aboriginal Land Commission, established in 1972. It purchased pastoral leases for resident or nearby Aboriginal groups that had been marginalised. in the late 1960s by the angry white pastoralists who refused to pay equal wages to their Aboriginal workers. Probably many small operators could not afford to. And as Aboriginal pastoralists found later, when their stake in the industry had dramatically increased, these post-feudal holdings could support an owner-manager family, but only agribusiness on a much vaster scale, or much more profitable uses of land and diversification, would enable larger populations of several hundred Aboriginal people in each community, as opposed to a typical grazier's family, to be economically supported. Meanwhile, in the Gulag Archipelago, the missionaries were asked to leave the reserves, and the reserve superintendents were replaced by village councils. And along with them, managed cattle herds, the sawmills, bakeries, butcheries, small cropping projects and cottage industries disappeared, deteriorated slowly into a state of irreversible failure, or simply closed down overnight. The order, discipline and management culture of the old imperial hands formed the glue that, however tenuously, held together the imposed regimes of settlement on the scattered Aboriginal groups in the hinterland. Years of apartheid in the education system and the almost total exclusion of Aboriginal people from normal training, apprenticeships and employment resulted in a rapidly growing Indigenous underclass in the towns and cities as Aboriginal families fled from the reserves during the 1960s and 1970s with the new wave of tolerance and thinking. Then two new forces collided with the Aboriginal world. Just as it seemed that perhaps the social and economic issues might be understood by more compassionate voters, 96% of them had voted yes for Aboriginal rights in 1967, the mining boom of the 1970s and the worldwide civil rights leftist and Indigenous movements precipitated a furious debate. Should Aboriginal reserves and freeholds and leases be readily accessed by mining companies without regard for the consequences on already impoverished and disadvantaged communities? Or should there be a special category of rights for Indigenous people encapsulated in settler states, where their fate was abuse and marginalisation? Only following the passage of the Native Title Act a quarter of a century later were some of the more incendiary issues in this dispute, which consumed three generations of Aboriginal leaders, partially resolved. I say partially because a further challenge has presented itself in this tortuous saga of base economic pushing and shoving of Aboriginal interests around the monopoly board. While the left romanticised and reinvented the textbook one-penny stamp Aborigine to great literary, cinematic and textual effect, creating partly true but misleading concepts, some mining companies were negotiating formal agreements with local traditional owners. With a brilliant research team at the University of Melbourne, I've worked for the last 6 years documenting developments in agreement making with Indigenous people, resulting in an online database, several books and many articles and public presentations. Our website is used globally and now averages 5 million hits per annum. At two recent symposia, one on mining and energy projects and one on tax, trusts and managing financial benefits, and as a result of my own investigations, we have worked on a number of economic management and governance problems in the emerging Aboriginal economic sector. The present global economic crisis has exacerbated the issues we have identified, but also presented opportunities. These issues are, some of which Warren has already described, a diversity of land title arrangements, or the need for a diversity of land title arrangements to encourage home ownership and commercial opportunities. Supporting opportunities for Aboriginal enterprises, particularly the successful Aboriginal contracting companies, such as the most famous of all, Ngada Civil and Mining, which employ a large proportion of the Aboriginal people in the mining and related industries, providing training for Indigenous people in corporate governance, financial management and other management sector, management areas, increasing the capacity of Aboriginal people to be employed and to create careers in a wide range of industries, amending the trust laws to enable Aboriginal economic development by reducing the taxation levels and capital risks of Aboriginal trusts and their commercial partners willing to invest capital or expertise. Ensuring probity and good governance in arrangements for financial benefits accrued in agreement making, especially native title mining dealings. So where do we stand in relation to these high priority policy issues? I regret to say that the situation is only different by a few degrees from that which Rowley and the Council of Aboriginal Affairs found in the 1960s and 1970s. It is true that there are almost 500 agreements with Indigenous people in the resource industry, that Indigenous Business Australia has supported business development and home ownership, that the Indigenous Land Corporation has purchased properties, many with commercial potential, and most heartening of all is the substantial Rudd government commitment to the Aboriginal Employment Covenant, on whose steering committee I have the honour of serving with Warren Mundine, my co-speaker tonight. But government policy responses, even in this financial crisis, with the $42 billion proposed stimulus package, are silent on the Aboriginal situation in this crisis. So too are Aboriginal leaders concerned with human rights, silent on these issues. On the collapse of contracts with Aboriginal companies as BHP and Rio Tinto and other companies reduce their exposure to the crisis. On the hundreds of jobs lost in the last few months to the first substantial Aboriginal industrial workforce, which numbered at the end of last year over 3,000 in the mining industry, and the jeopardy in which the many Aboriginal trusts are placed. These trusts have recently earned financial benefits which they have invested in the market in the last 20 years. These issues are not the affective or high emotional contact issues such as the Stolen Generations or the anniversary of Captain Arthur Phillips' ceremony held after his landing down the road from here. They are nevertheless the most important issues to be tackled in raising Aboriginal living standards and eliminating the horrible conditions and circumstances described so well by my colleague Warren Mundine. I am a board member of the entirely voluntary Aboriginal Enterprises in Mining, Energy and Exploration Association. This association receives no government funding. This year we will hold our fifth annual conference in Adelaide. Our members are concerned about these issues, and yet governments seem to be unaware, if we are to judge by media coverage, of the urgent need to develop policies and responses. In the midst of the debate about the $42 billion stimulus package, I urge everyone to think about focusing on these issues. I am not opposed to symbols. I understand perfectly well their power. There would be no Aboriginal rights, native title, or land rights without the power of symbols. But I am concerned that the federal government is putting at risk the opportunity for raising awareness of the economic challenges in the Indigenous communities and addressing them by playing to the populist issues. And I mean this with no disrespect at this time, a few days before the anniversary of the apology. But it is clear that the circumstances in the Indigenous world require serious economic policy responses along with symbols. Thank you.
Many thanks to Marcia Lathan and to Warren Mundine. Can I also just say thanks to Clayton Utz for the use of this fine facility this evening. And so we come to questions and discussion. Welcome to ABC Fora on digital television, who are here tonight. So if I have to repeat any questions, it's so the television cameras can pick up the questions or discussion. We have a lot of people here. We don't have a lot of time, but we've got, thanks for everyone to keeping their time, we've got nearly 25 minutes. So can I just start off just a brief response to both of you, because you've both covered very important economic issues, and as you know, we're in the global economic crisis. I mean, what would you wish that the federal government would do with, now that there is plenty of money to spend? I mean, $42 billion is a lot of money. What would you think that they should be doing in the areas that you're most interested in with respect to increasing or even maintaining Aboriginal employment of those initiatives that have come up in the last couple of years. So maybe we start with Warren and then we go, I think you'll have to come up here. Yeah. I'll put one chair on this side, one on the other side.
Okay. Oh, thanks. Thanks for that. To me, the economic stimulus is a great opportunity to address some of the issues that was raised by Amasia, and that is in regard to the infrastructure that's being developed. $6.6 billion has been put up for the housing. There's a great opportunity now for government to really, if they're going to be committed and really mean about closing the gap, $6.6 billion in housing construction over the next few years is going to be a great player in that marketplace. If we can get Indigenous contractors, which come out of the mining industry, because if you look at the contracting with the mining industry like NADA, you can build a mining camp, you can build a house, you can build a suburb. So we need to start transferring that across. You also need to start looking about how we can transfer the labour force, keep people in the labour force. It's about how we start doing things differently. In the past, one of the things I thought was quite amazing, I was sitting in a community once with 200 people, and there was these about 15 white guys standing over there building a house. And there were 200 young Aboriginal blokes sort of sitting here doing nothing. And I thought, you know, it didn't have to be rocket science to say, well, why, you're going into a community, why can't you employ and train and educate and get those people to build the houses? Then they can be used later on to maintain those houses, as well as then if the encouragement, one or two of them could set up their own little business and start being the service provider for that region. I reckon the economic stimulus, it gives us a lot of opportunities to maintain the standards that we've got ourselves into, but at the same time I'm a bit concerned that there may be opportunities lost.
Do you want to have a comment?
I've rung a few friends in the mining industry to ask what's happening to the Aboriginal contractors, and you know, a quick head count I did last year resulted in finding 30 Aboriginal contracting companies in the Pilbara. There are more in the Northern Territory and in Queensland. There are security firms here in Sydney, quite a number of interesting companies here in Sydney, and a few in Victoria, and of course some in South Australia. So, you know, we're talking about a relatively small number of companies, Aboriginal companies, that are exposed to the financial crisis, and especially to the resource sector. But all of them are capable of being switched over to infrastructure projects, and it seems to me, and I don't know how many decades it's been, as you know, we raise these issues over and over again, but it must be possible without breaching any of the, you know, basic commercial standards or occupational health and safety standards, and we've seen this happen in the mining industry, to give a leg up to these companies, especially because already there's, you know, as I said, hundreds of Aboriginal people have lost jobs in the mining industry, and this is our first industrial workforce in the Aboriginal communities. We can save those jobs, and we can create more jobs if a part of the stimulus package is, as Warren explained, allocated to ensuring that Aboriginal contracting companies get a fair go in the infrastructure projects. And of course, you know, there are many of them in the areas where these companies operate. I would add that this is the time to be investing in education, training, apprenticeships. Now we have the opportunity to just really focus hard on these issues, spend a lot of money on getting the Aboriginal youth educated, trained, with career opportunities, because when the economy swings back to a better position, you know, I think we'll be in a position then where it is quite normal for Aboriginal people to enter the workforce. One of the things that, you know, perhaps Warren can say more about is the I think, unprecedented and I wouldn't call it generosity, and I wouldn't call it charity, but I would just call it common sense of the corporate leaders who responded to Andrew Forrest's appeal through the Aboriginal Employment Covenant to come up with job commitments for Aboriginal people. There are 7,000 commitments at the end of last year, I understand. So, you know, that shows that, you know, it's just good common sense to give Aboriginal people a job in some industries and in some areas. And I see one of our steering committee members here, Andrew Penfold, hello. And, you know, I hope that one or both of you would have something to say about that. Thank you.
You said that attitudes have changed a lot over the past 5 years in relation to land reform, and I'm extrapolating that they might have changed in relation to economic issues as well. I was wondering why you think that they've changed and what we can do to bring people over to that side of the table in the future.
Sure. In regard to land reform, and I'll go back to my, you'd have to use your imagination here. I was a very young, sexy university student and a bit of a radical, did a lot of mad things as you do at university. And unlike Bill Clinton, I did suck in. What happened is that I was a strong supporter of land rights, strong supporter of native title. I still am. But the issue, we thought that by getting land rights and getting native title, the skies would open, the birds would sing, and everything would be wonderful, and we'd go on to living in the Garden of Eden. What we forgot was that there had to be a lot of hard work. And a lot of our communities, because of the issues that Marcia raised earlier, the invasion and colonisation process, and the way the structures were set up in education, a lot of our communities were not ready for this. We didn't have the educated people that needed to be in these positions to move forward. And of course, when the missionaries left and everyone else left, I know it's not PC to talk about these things, we've lost a lot within our communities. And of course, when Marcia talked about the bakeries closing, everything imploding, that's exactly what happened. So it took us 30 years of that experience to start thinking, well, there has to be something better than this. How do we make things happen? You know, it's all very good to have, you know, constitutional change and recognising us in the constitution, but how do I feed my kids tomorrow? How do I clothe my kids tomorrow? Now, that's not to put that down. They're very important issues, and I'm a great believer that Aboriginal people, like Australian people, can chew gum and breathe at the same time. We can deal with those symbolic issues, we can deal with those strong constitutional issues. At the same time, we can create an economy and get people educated. Education has got to be a major focus for this, and this is what we've got to do in regard to the employment. I'll just finish off, and he's getting a bit worried there.
No, I'm not. What's happening is that someone's hit a button and we've got another show.
I'm getting a bit worried because my little message sticks in there and my holiday shots may pop up. And I'm not... And me in a budgie smuggler is not pretty, I can tell you. So I'll just settle down there. Okay. What the people have come to the conclusion is, a lot of Aboriginal people, I've never met an Aboriginal person yet, and this is right across the spectrum, from remotes right across, who don't want their own house, who don't want to get their kids educated, who don't want to build a future for themselves. And all that's come together in the last 4 or 5 years and said, we can do things better. And so the climate of the Australian community has really changed a hell of a lot. But getting on to what Marcia wanted us to talk about a little bit earlier about the corporate Australia. In all my years, I've never been more optimistic about the future, even in this economic climate. And the reason for that is because every boardroom I've walked into in the last 18 months, every CEO and chairperson has been on site about doing something for Indigenous people that has a sustainable outcome that builds a better future for them. Not one. You know, some have been more enthusiastic than others, but there's not one person that I've not spoken to in the last 18 months of that. And I put that down to, and I do praise the symbolic people in regard to this, the Reconciliation Group, who have built over the last 15 years a tremendous environment for things to happen. Things are not perfect. If people would have seen the barometer that came out yesterday, but at the same time, the good news out of that barometer from the Reconciliation Council is what we really want to know each other and we really want to build the future for each other. And this is what is happening across the board.
Okay. Yeah, we'll go to Julie first. We're just going to see if we can turn this off. Julie, yeah.
Lauren Mundine, you mentioned the importance of equality for women if the gaps you identified and listed were to be overcome. As I understand it, in the developing international aid world, there's clear recognition that the education and economic development opportunities for women is critical to family and community development. I'm just interested in remarks from both of you. Where in your economic conversation does the equality of women and obviously the prevention of violence towards women and children, where does that fit? How does it mix together?
I push computers. I can't do it.
Okay, do you want to? You go, yeah. We're talking about equality here, but let Marcia go
first. I can remember saying to a group of feminists back in 1975, which was the decade of women's, you know, it was the first women's rights, the beginning of the women's rights decade, following CEDAW, the convention, and you know, they were urging us to get involved in their campaigns for abortion and so on. And some of us said to them, well, you know, actually they're not issues that are high on our priority. I mean, why would we support abortion with the infant mortality rates being what they are, with women's health problems being as bad as they are, and they were very bad back then, and why would we, you know, be interested in feminist issues when, you know, Aboriginal women haven't got a washing machine and, you know, don't have any prospect of going into the workforce except as volunteers in Aboriginal organisations. And I don't think that feminists ever really understood what we were saying until a few began to work with us. Yeah, and you know, it's people like Nanette Rogers who've now brought to attention, the country's attention, this, the problems that Aboriginal women face. So what are the answers? Well, the answers are much as we've described them here tonight. We've got to have better housing. We've got to have a home ownership, because I've been in Aboriginal houses where, well, communities where typically the number of people per house averages between 20 and 30. I've been in houses where there are 35 Aboriginal people living, you know. And this is, as has been identified in the Anderson Wild report, overcrowding is one of the problems. Also, you have the complex of problems that I've personally been describing for about a quarter of a century. Alcohol, drugs, grog running, lawlessness, gambling, and pornography. Now, these are very serious issues. And people here in the city have never been in the remote communities and turned on a computer in an Aboriginal organisation or a council office to find the most alarming pornography that you can imagine right there on the computer, should really take a deep breath and stop telling people like me that, you know, I'm opposed to human rights, or, you know, what I'm saying puts civil rights at risk. You know, take a deep breath and have a look at the statistics, have a look at the hospital admission rates, and then have a think about the impact that this complex of problems has had since they became legalised for Aboriginal people in the 1970s. Think about the impact in communities where you have basically uniform poverty and worse. Yeah, as I explained to a young Aboriginal person the other day who hadn't been to the town camps in Alice Springs, he said, "What's it like? Is it like, you know?" And he named a place in Darwin. I said, "No, brother, it's not like that. Think Darfur. Think suburb, range, you know, rocky little outcrops, a bit of Darfur. Suburb, rocky little outcrop, a bit more of Darfur." "Oh," he said. You see? So, it's, you know, it's quite a different range of problems from what people imagine here in the cities. And we must tackle home ownership, the health issues, education, jobs, and normalising life for Aboriginal people. Women's rights are respected in a context. And they're not going to be respected in many Aboriginal communities. I've spoken at judges' conferences. And the magistrate from the Northern Territory, you know, who does most of the big circuits, after I gave a presentation, said, "What am I supposed to do? Lock them all up?" And I'm thinking, well, yeah, good question, which is actually what everyone's actually doing. But, you know, what about thinking, getting past, and we explained all this in the Royal Commission, but people don't read the reports. Get past the simple sentencing options and start, and there are places in Australia where this is happening, you know, in North Queensland, for instance, compulsory anger management programs. Mm. You know, compulsory counselling for wife abusers, for child abusers. You know, don't let them off the hook. Give them 3 months, 1 year. Serial femicide is attracts a lesser sentence than car defaults, DUI, driving without a licence. That's the situation out on the new frontier. You know, and we have to start tackling this seriously. It's not good enough, but it can only be tackled in a broad range comprehension of what the problems are. Here in Sydney, I have been spat at and abused, as you were at Coffs Harbour, by people who think that I'm pro-interventionist and therefore I'm against human rights and I'm the enemy of everything good. Well, you know, grow up is what I have to say to these people. Grow up. And, you know, I've been abused in Alice Springs, and this is all, you know, this has taken up a whole column by Graham Ring in the National Indigenous Times recently, where he covers one of these, you know, mobile phone videos from a bunch of ratbags up in Alice Springs who bailed me up at a school function. I was at the Yuparinya school. And, you know, it was the 30th anniversary and I gave a speech. I was the special guest and I opened two buildings. I inaugurated two new buildings. These anti-interventionist campaigners turned up and disrupted that event and held the mobile phone to me. And, you know the sort of the Trotskyist syndrome. And, you know, I was exasperated and hot and, you know, and I was furious with them for disrupting a school day. And so Graham Ring's cherry-picked all the, you know, let's demonise Marcia Langton bits. So I'm all over the National Indigenous Times and once again the human rights squadron from Sydney, you know, gets a Guernsey. Well, look, the problems are just much too complicated for the simple minds of this world. And this is why I say we need serious policy responses, and many of them now are economic. Thank you.
Yeah, and that's correct. You know, I just find it amazing that people are willing to get up and have a go. When you look at the reports, you look at the Children to Sacred report, you look at the Gordon report in Western Australia, you look at the Bonnie Robinson report in Queensland, you look at the report of Breaking the Silence in New South Wales, you look at the Mulligan report in the APY. Homelands. These are not isolated reports. These are report after report after report after report after report of violence against women, of whether it be sexual, physical, or mental. It's a violence against children, whether it be sexual, mental, or whatever. And these are not our reports. These are the reports. These are not my reports. So these are the reports that we've got to act upon. I wish people would get up and march around for the protection of those women. I gave statistics there of 11 times the murder rate. You have to look at the rape rate. You have to look at the treatment of people. Those reports are damning reports, and we've got to deal with them. Let's deal with them in a constructive manner, and let's deal with them in a sensible manner. Now, you may not be happy about a lot of things that happen in the intervention, and I'm one of them. I'm not very happy about the setting aside of the Anti-Discrimination Act now. But you've got to deal with the violence. And every day those statistics, this is what those statistics are telling us over a 10-year period, it's getting worse for women within these communities, and it's getting worse for children within these communities. And you've got to confront that, and you've got to deal with it. Now, there's a lot of ways we can deal with it, and we've got to start doing it in constructive conversations. There's no good getting up and abusing each other and running off to the UN and doing this. I can tell you this now. Running off to the UN and taking that court case up is not going to save one woman's life within those communities. I can tell you that now. So I think people need to start concentrating on the real issues and start working for it. Betty Price from the Territory raised an issue that we were looking at domestic violence in Canberra the other day, and she said it's the issue about Aboriginal culture, Indigenous culture, a treatment of women and that. And her answer is very simple. Her answer was, I don't care whether it was traditional, I don't care whether it was not traditional. It is there. And we've got to deal with it as it is today. Not like it was 200 years ago, as it is today. Now that means we've got to change the law to protect these women and look after them and build these societies, then let's do it. But needs, and I mean law, L-A-W, and it's also a challenge to Aboriginal culture as well, that if it is in that culture, then they have to change that law. And the treatment of women has to be equitable. If it isn't, then it needs to be changed. And that's a challenge to our communities. I always find it very interesting that Western democracies, you get all these non-Indigenous people who are standing up there and fighting for women's rights and fighting for the protection of children. And when it gets to Aboriginal communities, their mind goes all gooey. And that's the problem I have. You know, I grew up in the Aboriginal community. I've seen violence, a lot of violence, just about every day. And I'm probably worse than the perpetrators because I was one of those blokes who turned a blind eye. And I just sat there and watched that violence continue. And one of the things that changed me around was I went to a court case at Bourke. I was taken up there by the Aboriginal Legal Service, Wolves it was, and we sat in that court case, and case after case after case. It was horrific. People have been to country circuits. It's not like city circuits where you have a children's court and you have a adult's court. They're both the same. So one sitting there, the children's court, the next sitting there, the adult's court. And you sat there and you look and you hear of Aboriginal men coming into those courts talking, saying, oh, look, I'm really sorry. It was the alcohol that made me do it. I'm really sorry. And you're looking at women, young women, 16, 17, 18, 20-year-old women sitting on the other side who have been slashed with bottles, who have been brutalised. And don't pretend that, you know, this is
11-year-olds.
This is not isolated. I sat in that court case after case after case after case after case. So you've got to deal with those issues and deal with them in a constructive, sensible way. That's the challenge for us all.
Well, we have many more potential questions, but it's 7 o'clock and it's been a very important night, and we've had two sad but very significant addresses tonight, and they'll be up on our podcast tomorrow and published when Anne puts out the Sydney papers in due course. So can I just say briefly to our two speakers, Marcy Langton, as you would have witnessed, has been a fine academic, a fine writer in her own right, but also someone who's particularly interested in the outcomes of her people, and we've seen that tonight in Warren Mundine as a political activist, but he's willing to speak to the Liberal Party, to the National Party, to the minor parties, as well as to his colleagues in the Labor Party, to community groups as well, but also most importantly, I think, in recent times, to business, and he's had a good response from business, as has Marcy Langton. So tonight we've had two very significant leaders in the Indigenous community. They've given important papers. We're very honoured that you've been here, and thanks for being so direct and so forthright. Many thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again.